This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here at NIC 2020 Vision in Oslo, and today we're going to be talking about AI, cloud, and what it means for us.
So I'm Jason Zanner. I'm the Executive Vice President for Microsoft Azure Worldwide. My team's job is to make sure that we can figure out where we plan all of our data centers around the world, do all of our fiber that supports everything, and we write all the software. We actually own silicon and hardware for Microsoft, in addition to not just the cloud, but across a broader spectrum. The operating systems, the core of the cloud, the software that we build, operations up through IoT, data analytics, the whole nine yards. So all the fun stuff that we get to do.
My name is Rune Syversen. I'm the founder and CEO of Crayon, a global partner of Microsoft.
AI has become a really hot topic, but the problem with AI is we're really still not quite sure what we're doing with it. We know what we're told to do with it, throw data at it, make something happen. But our data's in so many places. So I guess the first challenge for most companies is how do they actually not just create volume of data, but actually meaningful breadth and diversity from all those silos?
And I would say one thing in particular, which is having your goal of what is it you're trying to accomplish is super helpful. You're trying to go target this because, as you point out, there's a significant corpus of data out there. And in some cases, you might be holding on to a bunch of it. It's not actually going to help you with the end result. So the question is, what am I trying to do? One of the very concrete examples that companies have gotten a lot of value out of is things like predictive maintenance. And that's an example where figuring out the operational statistics that are coming off of sensors and sensor data and applying machine learning models to that, you can get a very good set of data from that. Then I think you start looking left to right and saying what other scenarios start to light up and how do I collect those. One of the things we're trying to do with the cloud is to make sure that structured, unstructured, any type of data that you've got can land it consistently in the Azure data lake. And then through things like Azure Synapse, I can actually very easily take that data and be able to extract data from it without having to do a lot of the classic wrangling thing. That allows me to collect a bunch of data, do it in a natural kind of way. I can filter out the stuff that I don't want, and then I can hopefully get quicker to some of the answers.
I think we're moving into a state now where we have been through most of the use cases. We're applying the models to those. Obviously, collecting the data is not the big problem. It's more how you contain them afterwards and also retain the quality of the data. We're slowly getting there now. At least our customers are starting to be conscious on how to manage them and build data lakes and have a strategy for the data, including privacy, security, and all that comes with it. We're moving into more or less a second phase now of AI and ML.
The word models is important here, because if we look at where we are with AI and ML at the moment, to a lot of people it's still just algorithms, it's about data science. But in order to have that security and that privacy and all those things that force us to keep data in silos at the moment, we need the AI itself to understand where the challenges are. How do we build the model and in that build in the awareness of what is privacy, of what data must stay in a particular region or silo for compliance and other reasons?
Start off first from a compliance perspective, even orthogonal to AI and machine learning. There is just the privacy and security rules around data itself. And so, for example, some of the data that I'm collecting, it may be subject to rules and regulations in the particular country or jurisdiction or whatever it happens to be. We do have ways, especially in the cloud and even some things at the edge, so that you can actually protect that data. You can say that this data, for example, is only in our Norwegian data centers, and it doesn't leave the Norwegian data centers, and it needs to be protected and held securely there. So you have those protections that can be built into the systems and to be able to store it down, and in some cases down to even more granular level of the data itself, like row-level encryption and things like that. You can put all those sorts of things into play. Then after that, if you look at where AI is commonly being done for training and for inference, if it's inside of that same cloud, well, then, of course, it can enter the same set of rules. There are other technologies that we're bringing to bear. Confidential computing is a great example of that. And that's a case where we've actually worked for 4 years with the silicon vendors, the chip vendors for CPUs, to actually be able to take your data and the encrypted version of that and keep the data private all the way down to the smallest level of computation. And so those are examples of way in which you can actually organize the data, keep it compliant, keep it secure. And that's true for whether I'm doing general purpose computing or I'm actually executing AI models, either training or inference?
It's actually a great question, because we're in the middle of investing now and building a model to test bias and also robustness of the models we're building for our customers. Long term, it's also important to look at security, privacy, whether it's GDPR or others, that we can build into these models. you will see that there will be models, and hopefully Microsoft will also build that to Azure, that you actually can test your algorithms for whether it's data privacy, security, or other topics. That's something you probably will find as a common service in the cloud going forward, but I guess that's something you know better than me.
Well, yes, because as you point out, being able to test all the models and being able to figure out all these dimensions around it is going to be a core part of all the AI going forward. So, yeah, I think you need to have those systems, and they have to be built into the core. It's just going to be very problematic, I think, for everyone to have to try and build it there on their own.
Within that challenge, however, bringing that data together, one of the fears is we use a lot of anonymized data we bring in from third-party sources. We know sometimes that if we mix anonymized data with non-anonymized data, we can remove the anonymization. And often it's by accident than by design. How can we make an AI aware when it's bringing data together and trying to find an answer for us that it needs to treat different classes of data differently?
We're in the middle of this now, particularly since GDPR came into the market, that you have to be conscious on actually how you use the data and what happens when you assemble data and look at the outcome. I think that's also back to one of the questions you asked earlier about how to secure that data you put together is actually used in a feasible way. And my thinking is that as you test for robustness, bias, other type of topics, you can also build that into the models that you can actually test them, that the outcome is not a data breach or any kind of data sovereignty or whatever. You have to build that as part of your AI and machine learning platform. I think you have to build this in layers, and you need a data foundation with a data lake and whatnot. And then you should probably look at building a platform that actually makes sure that the data you're using are compliant.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think classification of the data, where did it come from, how can I use it? And that can be true in this case, like you said, anonymized, non-anonymized. It can also be true when we start doing things where I want to do sharing between entities, like B2B or something like that, where I may have certain rights and usage for data, but that's kind of governed by the restrictions of agreements that I've signed. So how do we keep that in there? And of course, as the systems get smarter and smarter, the only way for them to work this way is to have the right kind of metadata flowing with the data itself. And now I have essentially rules-based systems around, here's where the data came from, here's what you're allowed to do, what not to do, etc. That all has to start all the way at the beginning with being able to describe and tag and classify that data from a governance perspective. Otherwise, we'll just never be able to make sense of it. And the rest of it then comes down to the algorithms and how they're applied and their ability to go back and actually trace that in a way that meets the compliance requirements.
We actually have a customer where when we assemble the data, the cell phone number of the user comes with the data. And as part of the algorithm we built, we actually rip out the cell phone number because obviously we're not entitled to use it, because that's obviously you can connect to the person. You have to apply that kind of model security to ensure that you're able to control the outcome of the algorithms that you actually build.
One of the challenges then that this brings to mind for me is who's going to do this work? If I look at the database teams, they're used to protecting rows of data, cells of data. This is what we've done for 20, 30, 40 years. If I look at developers, developers try really hard to write secure applications, but they're not data experts. We have a clash of cultures when we start to look at who's writing the applications and where the data's coming from. How do we find a balance between the tooling and how the tooling guides the developer and the needs to control and understand that data?
I'll just use my own experience with Azure and with Microsoft in general. We implemented GDPR like everyone else did. We were a compliant company. And one of the things that we found is we had our own sources of data in all disparate kinds of systems, some of it in relational, some of it non-relational, literally exabytes of data that we run the company on. That's just our own services. And so one of the things that we did was to go back and say, okay, well, to hit this compliance bar, we need to actually have tools, because it's just not practical, to your point, of expecting developers or even the data experts to go through and try and find everything. So we did build a set of tools that would go through, and they would do things, for example, like identify PII information, you know, whether it's cell phones or IP addresses or taxpayer numbers or whatever that happens to be. Basically, look for and sanity check that our catalogs and schemas were accurate. And if they weren't, how do we go get those updated? And then, frankly, then how does one put in, as Ruin was talking about, as the data is flowing through the system in a classic data wrangling sense, how do you get the right pieces redacted? How do you make sure what flows, etc.? And so I do think that the volumes of data that we're talking about and the sophistication levels, that having tools that automate this and make this a much easier task, at least from a recommendation perspective, that's like super important. Having the metadata for those flow through all of the systems that are getting used, because it's not just in a SQL database or it's not just in some kind of a document store of some sort. It's going to be flowing and joining all sorts of places. That data has to flow. And then I think developers can make the final choice based on the judgment of here's what the tooling is telling me and here's how I integrate them. Now, in our case, we spent a couple of years actually building out these tools internally, and then we have since taken a high percentage of them, but not all of them yet, but we've tried to take them and put them into our data and analytics products as well. So we're making them part of Synapse and others, because I feel like we had the same problem that all of our customers have too. How do I actually do this? It's not conceptually hard with respect to understanding it, but getting it right and operating in a compliant way and frankly doing it at massive scale, that's where the challenge comes in. You got to have tools.
Jason is absolutely right. And I think for us, coming from the consulting side, it's of course we apply the tools that Microsoft and others provide us with. Then again, we at least have experienced that you need different roles in the project with different roles and responsibilities. Of course, without tooling and the massive amounts of data, you're getting nowhere.
Once we bring all that tooling into play, we've still got to connect everything together. Our push for the last couple of years has been to build APIs. But there's kind of a feel of web services when I listen to the API conversation. And part of the failure of web services was that people tried to do too much. They tried to put all this stuff into a tiny container and make it work. APIs potentially have the same risk. People are trying to add things to their software to make things work better, but they don't necessarily know what they need to add or how they add it or where it needs to connect to. Can AI actually help us choose the right things to add an API to and in fact guide us through the whole what do we need to expose, how do we need to expose it?
I'll give you some examples, and I'm sure Rune has some he's actually worked on directly with customers. The parts that are interesting around this is there's actually new functionality and features in Visual Studio, for example, that leverages AI across a broad corpus of source code. And those are cases where it's going through and even looking for best practices on code that can be written, different kinds of bugs and patterns that people can get wrong, etc. And I think as you start to then look at that plus the data, there's AutoML and things like that around data as well. How do I go through and actually look at what should the default rules be for filtering and data wrangling, etc.? So it's not a huge leap to go back and say, okay, across the corpus of code and data state that I have, can you make some default recommendations on how this should flow, and I can base it on data, etc. Now, I personally think that it's great to have those tools and they can actually help and give you feedback like everything else. And then still at the end of the day, I think it does come down to an architect, to a developer, to someone that owns data to really look at the classifications and the way the data is organized and does it meet their intent and how do I actually provide that kind of guidance into the system? Because I think the human's going to have to wind up making the call. And then at that point, especially when you're formalizing it, there's a bunch of stuff we can do that's automatic if I just point at something and say, hey, can you figure out a good best guess? But if you're going to design APIs or things that are going to essentially be APIs that last for 3 decades, I think you want an architect ultimately involved with the final solution, and tools should be there to help them.
From my side, I would say typically, at least we try to learn from our mistakes. We have built over the last 3-4 years extensive IP on top of Microsoft, particularly to manage provisioning and self-service and the automation that comes with cloud. The way we have looked at this is that you need to keep it extremely simple, not to paint yourself into a corner, because complexity is immense and we can never be able to keep up to speed with what Microsoft and AWS and others are building. Our view is that at this point, you need to keep it simple. Then the other thing is that, and this is really the beauty of the cloud, is that it's really democratizing and commoditizing IT. And you get the tools and the features more or less out of the bag to manage this to a large extent. And I think you will also see that moving into the APIs as such, because in my view, APIs is key for the future for automation and the integrations needed. But you have to be extremely careful how much complexity you build on top of it. And as these platforms constantly evolve, you have to make sure you're capable of following what's going on from the big guys. And they're moving so fast now that you have to make sure that the layer you put on top has to be as thin as possible and as efficient as possible.
Two things start to clash here. If we look at organizations, we're struggling to move everything to the cloud. And that's because we've got a lot of old applications that we've always relied on. And most businesses are terrified to move those in case they break. Because if they break, business stops running. But at the same time, we know we want to get something of that into the cloud. But here's AI, and AI is pulling this together, and AI is throwing up all these new potential applications, these things that will not only change our business, but they'll disrupt our competitors. They will disrupt industries. Where's the role for AI in assisting the architect? Because we've talked about APIs, but actually, if we're trying to go cloud native, how do we begin to feed our code base to an AI that says, do you know, that application can reasonably be split into 30, 40, 50 chunks, and those chunks can be reused across all these other applications. Are we getting there? Is that a bit science fiction-y?
I would say no. I can use a live example from one of our customers, which is one of the largest certification bodies for ship design. So we actually built a model for them where we built a database of all the designs that they have approved over the years. And as soon as there is a new ship design or a new ship that's supposed to be built, that's matched against the database they have. You can do the same with code and make sure that you actually build for best practice. So you can test the different, even down to each tiny bit, that you have the right building blocks. And even more with software, I guess, where you typically would design, you will not put all the code in one place anymore. You would make sure that you have the bits and pieces that comes together and that you can measure the best practice across different parts of the application.
And then concretely, I think we have actually built in Microsoft a combination of tools that actually enable this. I mean, there's some that do more lexical scanning across source code. You can look for the patterns. And like I said, even if you look at open source projects, have even gone through and been able to index, again, with appropriate use rights, but being able to actually look for common patterns and things that are high voted and everything else so that you can actually provide. Those are examples of the building blocks. There's also dynamic tracing in places where you can run executing code and actually looking at the commonality of how it executes and comes back. Some of these tools have already been used for architectural refactoring in cases where somebody owns a particular project and they're actually just simply trying to take their existing project and get that to be more efficient. So we actually have a whole bunch of this technology now and we've actually built it out. In some ways, that's just common statistical analysis. Applying machine learning on top of that, that's another opportunity to be able to make those algorithms even more advanced. But at the end of the day, you're just trying to find the right subsystems, the right kind of boundaries, make sure that you articulate those in the right way, and then refactor the code accordingly. Most people don't get an opportunity to do a greenfield. I get to start with file new project. That happens on stage a lot in demos. Doesn't usually happen in an enterprise, though. I got to figure out how to do that in a rational kind of way. Any tooling that can help with that is great.
It's all about pattern recognition, and we have the perfect tools for it.
Also raises that whole challenge of deprecation of code, doesn't it?
Some of the most careful time you spend as a developer is taking stuff out. You know, that's not a bad thing to do sometimes.
We see a new lot of opportunities for AI. One of those is things like autonomous cars. When we consider the number of systems in a car, the amount of data we're told that autonomous cars are going to generate, there's an awful lot going on, way more than a driver can do, and way more than a lot of current compute can realistically handle, which is why we're still in so many tiny little trial phases at the moment. How far away are we from having AI that can not only be deployed into a vehicle, but more importantly, uses the very low levels of compute that a vehicle is going to have? Because it's not going to have a cloud data center with it. It's not going to have a quantum computer sitting in the passenger seat. But it's going to have to make vast numbers of decisions every second, especially in major cities with all that traffic and pedestrians and everything else going on.
Yeah, I'm really hoping it doesn't need a quantum computer because, you know, because you got to have room for the liquid nitrogen. I mean, just to get the temperature down, it'd be like the flux capacitor in Back to the Future, man. but in some ways, we've even joked that some of these autonomous vehicles, they almost are like a little data center. If you think of the LiDAR systems that are in there, the number of systems that are required to make it go, you are actually packing quite a bit of computing power today, whether it's going to be some kind of a GPU or some other high-end systems, FPGAs, etc. I do think that that level of compute power on board is going to be required. And in fact, most of the existing systems that operate this way today, they do actually have that. There's going to be a couple of things that happen. One, there is a difference between real-time systems that you need for braking and safety and all those sort of things like that versus the cabin controls and things like that from a passenger sort of perspective. There's different buses and there's different kind of technology that's in the vehicle, but they can actually interoperate with each other in a cross-domain kind of way. When we start talking about the autonomous piece, which is what you're talking about, that's where we get into more of the real-time systems. My expectation is that as we get even more advanced on the silicon work that we do, and in fact start customizing silicon more towards the inference models that are required, because inferences is different depending upon the sort of domain that you're in, then you will start to see more verticalization of the scenario. You'll start to see more of that power come through, and so the silicon plus the software will handle a lot of the environments that you're talking about. That's kind of where we're headed. And honestly, like you said, there's a lot of data going through. And the more and more you work on it, there's even more parts of the vehicle that will become part of that core.
If you add 5G to that equation, I would anticipate you're getting there anytime soon, to be honest.
That whole question, though, of silicon becomes increasingly interesting. We've relied on GPUs to take us to where we are now. We've had FPGAs for a while, and they're suddenly getting a real big push forwards. All of that new silicon raises a question as to whether we have the capacity in the semiconductor industry to take these things into there. And once we get that software into there, how do we then audit and update and manage it downstream? We struggle to manage patch management today in most organizations. The idea of just popping over to the car and pulling out an FPGA and slipping a new one in doesn't flow.
You know, I wouldn't expect people to actually do it that way. If you think about the typical model for any kind of appliance, and I'm using air quotes here, you can't see over the podcast, but appliance, I mean, my car is kind of like an appliance. It was built and tested and designed with a particular set of components, and I don't expect that one is going to actually be popping off and changing different types of the silicon layers or those sorts of things as well. Instead, what you would do that you point out is I could have updates to the firmware, I could have updates to other things. That we can and should expect. I mean, in fact, it's going to be a matter of, as the models get better, and for example, if for an autonomous vehicle, if I can figure out an even better trained model that does an even better job of, say, collision detection or other sort of safety features, I probably do want to have that onto my existing systems. But that, again, is where the over-the-air updates can and will take place, firmware, etc. And it has all the same issues that you have for those sort of systems today, because as you know, when you go into service for your vehicle, they're also updating some of the firmware that actually operates your engine and other sort of components that are there today. So there certainly can and will be processes for that to be able to go pull that off. I think the key thing for us is we have to maintain safety at all costs, no matter what. That's the imperative. So that update chain, et cetera, has to work in that way.
One of the things that is really under-communicated around the cloud is the fact that everything you put in there actually has to be managed. And it has to be managed for a long period of time. Take a scenario where a car manufacturer goes bankrupt. Who's going to take care of the updates and manage the data? Because there is nobody there. We haven't really seen the real impact of it. Going forward, there will be much more emphasis on how you manage this long term and how you actually make a sustainable model. Take cars, as you mentioned, over the lifetime of a car, you have to think differently than you typically would do in a traditional IT scenario where you have maybe 3 to 5 year scenarios that you're working in. A car at least stays alive for 8 to 10. That's something that is going to be a hot topic going forward, to be honest.
Let's take a jump into the future. If we look at where we are with AI at the moment, we pull vast amounts of data in. That costs a lot of energy to move the data, store the data, manipulate the data. We're using GPUs, which are not the most energy-efficient devices on the planet. Let's think about quantum computing. If we look at the potential for AI with quantum computing, how much does the imperative to deal with climate change, how much does the imperative to become faster, be real-time, help with AI to bring it to quantum computing and get the two of them accelerated together?
At least for us, the way we're looking at this is we see the potential for quantum computing to actually impact in kind of exponential ways certain problem spaces. And you mentioned the keynote up front. We talked about things like, you know, better fertilizer, feeding more people on the planet, carbon capture, materials science, etc. Machine learning used one of those as well. And we believe that we're going to need probably in the 1,000-qubit range in order to be able to do an effective job of that. Now, to me, the goal on this would be to say, if we can leverage quantum computing and quantum algorithms to solve problems in, frankly, minutes that would have frankly taken about what would be considered infinite, way past any of our lifetimes to actually do on a classic computer, well then, in some ways, we're concentrating a lot of the power. So we're able to get much, much more computational power into a smaller form factor than I might have, for example, than a massive supercomputer that needs to run at a high wattage with high heat dissipation and other sort of things as well. That can and will be an interesting dynamic as to how we go do that. At the same time, what I would just say before we even get to quantum, one of the commitments that Microsoft has made is to be carbon negative by 2030, and that includes all the work we do in our data centers and anything related to Microsoft and its operations. And so from that perspective, we can and will continue to make sustainability investments in alternative energy and other things to power our data centers, and then also when we manufacture and create silicon and we create the hardware and other sort of things as well, how can we do that in an efficient way? And the other thing to even just think about is the consolidation of literally thousands of data centers around the planet, but perhaps into smaller, more efficiently run cloud hyperscale solutions, I think that can actually have also a positive effect, because now I have the responsibility of thinking at a very large scale how to make it very, very sustainable, and I can do that in one place as opposed to 1,000 companies trying to figure out how to optimize their own data centers. So I think there's some opportunities that are very near term, and you know, in the longer haul, I'm looking forward to quantum. I think it's going to be really cool.
Jason mentioned a lot of critical points, and if you just look at operational efficiency across the board, there is so much you can do with AI to make it more efficient. And I think take logistics as an example. If you can reduce the number of cars going around just to do distribution, whether it's for Amazon or for anyone else, there is so much you can do with machine learning and AI to improve that value chain. And also my read is that the hyperscalers and Microsoft in particular are very concerned also about the power sources and moving much into renewable energy, which I think is also key. But consolidation of data centers is probably where they're going to make the biggest effect short term.
Thank you both very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.